Welcome, everybody, to the new Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowden. With me is my co-host, Barry Rose, fresh back from a trip to Mexico. Hola, Barry. Buenos dias.
Senor, I am back. I am back from Mexico. I am ready to go back to Mexico, but, I missed Ozzy too much, so I had to get back to Philadelphia.
The Ozzy versus the grilled octopus tacos. Which one are you going to take?
I will miss you, Ozzy. You've been a great dog.
And on this show, we are not just going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We will break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, music, pop culture. We're going to break kayfabe on life. On today's show, we are going to discuss... See, you thought I was going four matches. We're talking one match today from my top 80s, the top 100 of the 80s. We're also going to discuss, here's a shocking one, some current matches that we've recently seen on New Japan World. And also, I know you're going to be stunned, folks. Thanks to my good friend Barry Rose, I'm now on the WWE Network. Thank you. Mic drop. And we're also going to discuss Quentin Tarantino films because Quentin has been in the news, Barry, and he may not be long for Hollywood. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm really concerned that he won't be long for Hollywood. Tarantino, too, is probably my all-time favorite director because I love every one of his films. He's made 9 movies. I can watch them at a drop of the hat. So he's right up there. But, yeah, I'm real excited about today's episode.
Yeah. So before we get started with our discussion on our one match from the 80s that we're going to talk about, got a couple of anniversaries that we're celebrating here today on the day of this podcast recording, and it's not happy anniversaries. We realize today that today is 34 years. Good Lord, Barry, how has 34 years passed since we found out about the death of David Von Erich? Good Lord Almighty. And also, it has been 15 years since Mr. Perfect, Kurt Hennig, passed away, both of them tragically and way, way too young. So, Barry, let's start with David Von Erich. Tell us some memories of David Von Erich, especially his run through Florida since you're Mr. CWF.
Yeah, so, and I think I've said this before. I know that I've said this privately, but I believe I've said it on our podcast as well. David Von Erich in Championship Wrestling from Florida in 1982 may have been the highlight of the 1980s. He was that good as a heel. He was this kind of gangly, awkward, snarky kind of heel, and his team with Dory Funk Jr. And Dory was playing the mentor role, which I just love so much. And he was great. He came in, he quickly won the Southern title, and he was the top heel in the state. You know, it was he and Dory, but he was really the top heel in the state. And for me, David Von Erich, he was a guy, you know, I was never a big Von Erich fan the way that it was presented in World Class. It was always too homesteady, baby face for me. Just something about it. I was more of a Freebirds guy, or, you know, an Adams and Hernandez, had the handsome half breed. That appealed to me. But David Von Erich is a heel. Oh my God, was he tremendous. And there's been this debate, which you know, you've heard it, you've read about it. David Von Erich was being groomed for the NWA title. And I don't know if I ever believed that. You know, people would say that, well, the reason he was down in Florida was because Dory was going to show him how to work heel, and then he eventually was going to win the world title. And you know, I just took that as conjecture. That's just one of those things that, well, maybe that would have happened, you know. And maybe if Magnum had not gotten in the car crash, maybe he would have been champion. We'll never know this stuff. But if you recall, when you were moderating the last CWF Legends Fan Fest, number 2, that took place in October in Tampa, Kevin Sullivan made a statement about that. Do you recall that?
No, I'm drawing a blank. What did he say?
Yeah, so Kevin Sullivan basically said, he was talking about, you know, Florida in the 1980s, and Sullivan basically said David Von Erich was purposely brought to Florida. They were going to use him as the NWA World's Heavyweight Champion at one point. So that was the first time I had ever heard a wrestler, and let's be honest, Kevin Sullivan was on the inside. I mean, he spent, you know, so many years really deep on the inside. So he basically was the first time I'd ever heard a wrestler verify that information. And, you know, for years I would say, well, how do you know that? How, you know, fans always threw that out there, and I would always question that. You're speculating. We don't know that. Well, Sullivan says it. I'm actually going to give a listen to it and believe it.
Yeah, I've said it not only here but on the 605 podcast. The mothership! David Von Erich was part of the reason why I came back to wrestling in 1982. I kind of drifted away a little bit. Championship Wrestling from Florida during 1981 was really not in a great place. You had Charlie Cook as the Florida champion. I'll just leave it there. But in 1982, when I saw David Von Erich as a heel working there, he was one of the guys that really just kind of made my ears perk up and say, hey, this guy, I got to pay attention to what this guy's saying. And I'll never forget, you know, you spoke about Dory Funk Jr. acting as his mentor, how when they would do promos, David Von Erich used to hold up signs that said, Mr. Funk is number one. And those just used to crack me up so much because he was just like this little weaselly guy that was the friend of a bully. You know what he was like? You talk about the movie A Christmas Story, and the bully was Scott Farkas. It was his little toady that hung around with the bully in A Christmas Story. That was David Von Erich in Florida, and he played the role so well. And, you know, he used to – I'll never forget also that he famously, and boy, you can tell this was in the early 80s as opposed to in the mid part of the decade, he was getting ready to have a match with Butch Reed, and he cut a promo on Butch Reed. He said, hey, Butch Reed, you know, anyone can take steroids and have a good body. My body's natural, baby. And again, that's just, he was so great in Florida. And it leads me to wonder if there was somebody in the Von Erich family that was in line to be considered for a future world title run. Would it have been David or Kerry? I don't really think Kevin would have gotten the run, quite honestly. Nothing against Kevin personally. But I think Kerry had the fan appeal that could have carried him to a world title reign. It might have been brief, but, you know, and obviously he had one. But if David had never passed away, I think David would have gotten a run because I think David was seen within the wrestling community as the most stable of the three brothers, the one you could rely on the most. And whether that was because of the time he spent away from his family in Florida and he established himself in another, you know, characterization, I think that might have played something into it. But I could definitely have seen him getting, if nothing else, a short run with the title to give Flair, vacation from it or whatever. Obviously, Flair was going to be the long term guy for the NWA title. But I could definitely see David getting a brief run. Now, Curt Hennig. A guy that we've recently talked about here after his one-hour Broadway match with Nick Bockwinkel. That was one of my top 100 of the 80s. Another guy that just, what a super talent. And, you know, I was thinking about Kurt earlier today, and I was thinking to myself, boy, it would have been nice to see Kurt get a run with a title, you know, a world title. And then I remembered, well, actually, he had a run with a world title. The problem was at the time, the AWA title had basically been so devalued that it almost wasn't – you didn't – come off thinking that he was a world champion, but had a memorable run in the WWE with Bret Hart and just a tremendous talent, a bump taker extraordinaire. I know, Barry, that although you like Kurt's work, you thought the stuff in WWE was a bit exaggerated and you weren't such a big fan of that. But, you know, there's no question Kurt was a hell of a talent and a hell of a hand.
Yeah, when you look at that match, too, that was probably a month or two back where we looked at the match between, it was the 60-minute Broadway between Bockwinkel and Hennig. That's got to be one of the greatest U.S. matches of all time, and it really does. And I was on Facebook today, and I was scrolling through, and our good friend Chris Aha, who lives in Chicago, that is somebody who supports us and listens every week, actually took a photo. I think he was watching the match over the last day or two, and he's a huge Bockwinkel and Hennig fan, and is also fighting the flu right now. I should say, shout out to Chris. Get better, my friend. But that is such an amazing match, and there are a few matches that I can sit for 60 minutes and watch on television and be glued where I'm not even blinking. That's how great I thought that match was. So his stuff in the WWE, we've said it, you know, WWE, they're never going to show, it's never going to be your best showcase of your work. It's going to be somewhere else. And, you know, it's unfortunate that I think, you know, had a guy like Kurt, and more power to him. He deserved to go there to make all the money, whatever it was. But he went there, he really destroyed his body and his back by taking those bumps. But the stuff you see in the AWA, and I've seen some of his Portland stuff, this guy was a major, major league star.
Yeah, he absolutely was just a tremendous guy. A guy that was just so well-respected in the dressing rooms, too. And, you know, I know that Steve Kern told me one hilarious story about a rib that he played on Curt Hennig when Curt Hennig was coming to Memphis as the AWA world champion. So that being said, I'm going to throw that little nugget out there. I'm going to have Steve Kern at the CWS Fan Fest on June 2nd in Lutz, Florida. That was for my sister. Lutz, Florida. Since we're going to have Steve Kern there as part of our fan fest, I'm going to have Steve tell the story about the rib that he played on Kurt Hennig in Memphis, because I got to tell you, it's an all-time classic. Barry, do you remember that story?
I don't remember that story.
Okay, I'll tell you off the air. Yeah, that's true. And based on the rib, it's a good thing you weren't. Okay, so what we're going to do, first of all, we are going to go back to September 20th, 1988. We are talking Toshiaki Kawada and Samson Fuyuki versus Shinichi Nakano and Shunji Takano. I believe this was at Corican Hall. This was a match that I remember when it came out, when it first broke in the Observer, it was really well received. I got to be honest, before I throw it to you, Barry, I watched this match at work about 6 days ago, was taking notes on it, and at the time I watched it, I thought to myself, and there's really not a lot happening here. This match doesn't really, it isn't really ringing my bells. And I was sitting there thinking, I'm going to basically trash this match when we start talking about it. Somehow I managed to lose my notes because I'm completely inept in, that regard. So I had to watch the match again this morning. I watched it again this morning, and I liked it a lot better. Barry, tell us what your thoughts are on this match.
Sure, Jeff. And you and I are nothing if not professional broadcasters.
Exactly.
I actually watched this match, and almost identical to your situation, I lost my notes as well. So I had to go back and take a look. But I will say I liked it both times that I saw it. And that's really the reason that I went back, because I wanted to be able to have a few notes. These were two of the best teams, and what I think is cool about these two teams, these are two of the most underrated teams that you'll ever see. Nobody ever really talks about Footloose, Kawada and Fuyuki. And by the same tone, Takano and Nakano, you never hear anything. They were this great kind of heel team for Japan that I think could have gotten over in the U.S. as well. Two kind of taller, similar builds, dressed all in black, though Takano's wearing white boots, but they had this like kind of menacing aura about them that I just think would have played so well in the U.S. And Footloose was so cool back in the day. I was such a Kawada fan, and it really started with Footloose and, the stuff they would do. So I did take some notes on it. Kawada and Fuyuki used to come out to Kenny Loggins' version of Footloose, the song, which to me is like just the oddest thing, because you've got this team that is kind of a kick-ass team. They're kind of tough. There is this almost Rock and Roll Express type of vibe. They wear matching long red tights, but at the same time, their in-ring work is just fantastic. This match starts off, Fuyuki and Nakano, they're having a stare down in the middle of the ring, and Nakano's probably 6 or 7 inches taller than Fuyuki at this point, and they're having this stare down, and Fuyuki slaps Nakano right in the face. I mean, a slap that you could hear. Nakano doesn't care, slaps him right back, and they sit there and trade slaps for about 30 seconds before Fuyuki actually gets him in the corner. There's a lot of fighting outside the ring during this match, and this is not fighting where I'm whipping you into the ring post or anything. These guys are beating the shit out of each other outside the ring, and this is that late 80s All Japan style of wrestling that, these guys were going for it. There's a chair shot that Fuyuki takes to the back, and there are several chair shots in this match, but that one chair shot, I think the guy in the top row was able to hear that. Really, really stiff. It's a solid match back and forth. Takano goes for a spinning toe hold, which I just thought was so cool, and it may have been, no disrespect intended to anybody that's ever used that as a finisher, but that may have been the best-looking spinning toe hold I've ever seen. He gets rolled up, but I'm going to let you describe the ending, because I thought this ending was just fantastic. I thought the way that this match went, and then when this ending showed up, I was like, wow, that's actually pretty cool.
Yeah, just to clarify, the guy that opened this the match with Samson Fuyuki, that is Shunji Takano, not Shinichi Nakano.
Oh, Takano, not, it wasn't Takano. Yes.
And, yeah, you're right. It's interesting. Takano is a real interesting guy in the history of All Japan Wrestling. He is the brother of George Takano, who wrestled as the Cobra in New Japan. And George Takano later took off the hood and just wrestled as George Takano. His brother Shunji, at this point, the belt that they're wrestling for in this match is the All-Asian Tag Team titles. And I always thought that Shunji Takano, for whatever reason, was a guy that I'm really surprised, based on the kind of stuff that the Japanese promoters like to see. He looks like a guy that's going to be the eventual like lead star in one of the promotions, because he's basically built a little bit like Barry Windham was at this point. He's a tall guy. He's not muscular. He's not, you know, ripped up. He's just, but he's got a good wrestling physique, because he's the kind of guy that looks like he can wrestle 60 minutes and not even be breathing hard, for God's sakes. Yeah, those chair shots you were talking about. Fuyuki takes one from Takano. Then Takano, you know, gets one back from Fuyuki. There's all kind of, the slaps are just insane, especially between Fuyuki and Takano. They do a move where there is a Samson Fuyuki has a crucifix on Nakano, and then Takano comes in and drops a leg drop across his throat that I thought was a great looking spot. The finish of the match goes about a little over 19 minutes, and Kawada comes in to do a leg lariat on Shunji Takano. There's a sit out by Samson Fuyuki into a reverse cradle, and they get the win to win the titles back that they had just lost, I think, the week before. So, yeah, this actually was a really good match. Do I think this is like a top 20 match? No, I think this is probably, like I was referring to a match last week between Choshu and Fujinami. Yeah, this is probably in the 90s if I had to. But there is absolutely nothing wrong with this match. This is a good I won't even say good, because that makes it seem like it's kind of trite. This is a really good match. And like Barry said, the chair shots, the slaps across the chest, they're in Cork and Hall. And I'm telling you, when these guys slap one another, it sounds like there's a gun going off. Barry? I know we're not going to forget those slaps that we saw in this match for a long time.
No, they really are, too. And we can talk about slaps and chops, but when you see it and when it happens that quick, and it's so loud, too. And, you know, Footloose, to me, was such an interesting team, and they were done by, like, 89 or 90. So they really didn't make it past the 80s at that point. They teamed for 4 or 5 years. I actually looked them up. Did you know they actually started in Texas together?
Yes, I had no idea. As the Japanese force.
Yeah, I guess they were feuding with American Force, who was Paul Diamond and Shawn Michaels.
Yeah.
Shawn Michaels, tremendously overrated, huge douchebag. So
it seems like we'll get a lot of play off of that one. You mentioned that, right? Yeah. You're like a star.
Yeah, that really took off this week. But
I'm going to have to start thinking of something controversial to say so I can get those kind of numbers on Facebook there.
Yeah, I don't know. It just, you know, yeah, the truth. Just say how you feel. I think that's what it was. But these guys were great. And when you see Kawada, the evolution of Kawada from being one half of a tag team in Japan, again, where I'm comparing them to Rock and Roll Express, that really isn't accurate, because they weren't like a teeny bopper type of tag team, even though the Footloose song would almost say that they were. But at the same time, you know, he's thinner, he still has his front teeth, and you just look at, you know, the way he evolved over the next 4 and 5 years, where he put on the weight, he's so much thicker, he's missing his teeth. And as you mentioned last week too, this style will kill you, because he looks old, Kawada. His hair doesn't, though, which I don't know if that's either if he's dyeing his hair or if he's wearing some sort of a wig, because he looks like he has the hair of like a 20-year-old. But facially, yeah, he looks like an old man now. And this style would actually do that to you.
Yeah, I think, you know, if we're going to make a comparison to Kawada in this, let's just put it out there, kind of rock and roll tag team gimmick, I think like either Bret Hart or Shawn Michaels, as much as I'm sure you hate for me to say it, the comparison is that you have guys that start off in tag teams where they're obviously the best guy in the tag team. No offense to Jim Neidhart and Marty Jannetty, but obviously Shawn and Bret were the ones that were the key parts of their team. And then they take a guy who's a tag team wrestler, and they end up putting him in the main events as a single wrestler. And that's kind of what happened with Kawada. Kawada eventually evolved out of the tag team type of stuff with Fuyuki and with Misawa, to where he and Misawa became, you know, two of the four cornerstones of the franchise. So there's no question. Now we're going to switch gears a little bit, and we are going to talk a little modern day wrestling. I know some of you out there are probably thinking, holy crap, Baudrin's going to talk about today's wrestling and not just New Japan. We're going to also discuss a little WWE. Before we get to that, we're going to talk about a match that we saw that was recently part of the New Japan World New Beginnings. And that was Minoru Suzuki versus Hiroshi Tanahashi. And Barry, you had a chance to watch this match. And we're not going to do the type of deep dive that we do on our 80s matches, but just give me your initial thoughts when you saw this, because, wow, I thought this was one of the best psychologically driven matches. The psychology in this match was just amazing. Tanahashi was selling like he was stinking Jack Briscoe facing Dory Funk, and Minoru Suzuki just played the prototypical heel wrestler working on a body part. It was like watching Ole and Gene Anderson, for God's sakes. So tell me what you thought of this match.
Yeah, well, Suzuki, too. And, you know, you go back and and I remember Suzuki from the 80s. The guy's been wrestling for 30 years. He'll be 50 years old this upcoming year. And he is such a heel. And his mannerisms, everything he does in the ring, I just think is tremendous. He's an anomaly. I mean, when you look at what he's doing right now, his body of work, this guy is an anomaly. He's not getting by. You know, Suzuki is having matches. He's having kick-ass matches. And as a heel, you know, he's stone-faced. Before the match starts, he shows zero emotion. He doesn't. He stares off into the arena. He will not look at his opponent. And, you know, when he does this thing, you know, he'll stomp on Tanahashi and he'll laugh at him. It's like this evil kind of maniacal laugh almost. And it's not over the top. It's like it's almost low key, but at the same time, it's so heel intensive. I thought this match was just fantastic. And you hit on a key word right there, which is psychological. This is not a match that it's going to have a ton of high spots. There's not going to be a lot of flips and dives and shit like that. This is a lot of mat work and a lot of heel work by Suzuki on Tanahashi. So let me ask you a question. As I watch Tanahashi, and I've always thought Tanahashi, and I know before Okada, Tanahashi was really the guy in Japan, at least for New Japan, but Tanahashi could have made it in the U.S. You know, what do you think the logic was in bringing in Shinsuke Nakamura? And this is not a knock on Shinsuke, because he certainly was super over in Japan, and the guy's got the charisma literally of Dusty Rhodes in Japan. But Tanahashi has a look that I think he could have been a huge babyface in this country. What do you think about that?
You know, it might have just been a case where a guy didn't want to travel. You know, Nakamura actually, I think, wanted to travel to the States. That was one of his goals. Maybe Tanahashi, but you're absolutely right. Tanahashi absolutely could have come. You know, the whole, I have to be honest with you, I think it's absolutely ridiculous to take a guy with the charisma and the working ability of not only Tanahashi or Nakamura, but like an AJ Styles, and you put him into NXT where they have to learn how to work WWE style. I just think that's completely absurd. You know, obviously you have a young guy that's just breaking into the business that needs experience. I completely understand that. But the whole mindset of let's teach him how to work our style, the slower, you know, more methodical style, I just really kind of repulses me on the WWE. But that being said, could he have gotten over? Absolutely. He's got a great look. The psychological ability, the way he conveys his emotion in the match, and his work rate is, you know, he's they call him the once in a generation performer. And perhaps in Japan, he is. Maybe he could have come to the States like someone like Kijimuto did, and he could have gotten over to that regard and to that extent. But yeah, no, definitely. He definitely could have made it in the States. And I'll tell you something, you know, Barry mentioned that there's not a lot of high spots. There's a lot of mat work on there, a lot of working of the leg. You know, obviously Tanahashi has worked for, God, I don't know, the past few months at least, with an injury to his arm that really needed some attention. So in the match, the whole spot is that Suzuki is working on his leg, and he's selling it like he's getting his leg broken or his knees blown out. But there is a spot in here, and I posted it on the Facebook page, the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry Facebook page, where Suzuki hits a drop kick on Tanahashi. And I'm here to tell you, I've been a wrestling fan for almost 45 years. I have never seen a drop kick like that. And the way the air that Suzuki, who's this, you know, UFC, Pankrazi, whatever, rings kind of style worker, and the air that he gets and the way he connected on Tanahashi's face, it was a holy shit moment, because it was absolutely amazing. Barry, please tell me you saw that spot.
Yeah, absolutely, too. And if you haven't seen it, the link is up there, and you do have to see it. But essentially, he whips Tanahashi into the ropes and then hits him with this running drop kick. And, I mean, he purely connects with it. There's no, you know, he's absolutely connecting with it. But that's really what the tone of this match is. That, you know, even when Suzuki's working the heel hook on Tanahashi, and it's a heel hook, the way Tanahashi sells it, and Suzuki with his facial expressions – It's the most believable heel hook you'll ever see. There's a great spot in here, too, where Suzuki's got the figure four on Tanahashi, and Kevin Kelly, and Kevin Kelly's great. Kevin Kelly starts to mention people that have used the figure four. And in this order, sequential order, he says something to the effect of Suzuki with the figure four on Tanahashi, the same way that Eddie Graham, Jack Briscoe, and Ric Flair have done it. And I love that, the fact that he goes back to Eddie Graham and Jack Briscoe, not starting off with Flair or The Miz or, you know, somebody like that, somebody currently. Exactly. I thought, wow, that's awesome, too. And to your point also, when you're talking about Tanahashi and how they put him over, Kevin Kelly does say that Tanahashi is possibly the greatest big match wrestler of all time in the early commentary of this match. So, this is a match that I think also has to be seen. Wrestling is so much more than me doing a quadruple flip off of the top rope. And when you watch a match like this, I think you learn. There is this deep understanding and this learned behavior as you're watching a match like this, because not everybody could do this. You know, if this was done in the U.S., if two guys who are good workers in the U.S. attempted to do this on the big stage like the WWE, this would fail. This could not work. Japan, this actually works, and this is a match I'm going to go back and watch again.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely tremendous. Now, speaking of the WWE, Barry and I have recently had a chance to watch the NXT TakeOver from Philadelphia. Great crowd. The crowd was super, super pumped, super into the match. We're going to talk about the main event, but before I do, I want to talk about the match that was a semi-main event, which is Aleister Black and Adam Cole. I have to tell you folks something. I do not watch the WWE. It is not the wrestling that I grew up on. It's not the wrestling that I particularly care for. I've had a shout out to my friend Greg Good, who's been trying to convince me for over a year to check out NXT. And I watched a good part of the show, and I was pretty damn impressed. And I have to tell you something. You know what? I remember it was the Okada Omega match from a year or so ago that really got me back into watching New Japan. I had been out of watching the current product pretty much for good. They got me back and to where I was watching New Japan every single week, and I ended up buying the New Japan World Service. That's how much I got into the New Japan product that they were pushing. I started watching this NXT, and I basically sat back on the couch with my buddy Gunny, and I said, okay, Gun, let's see what they got to show us. And Gunny gave it two paws up. He said, good stuff, Dad. And the first thing that I started watching was the Aleister Black versus Adam Cole match. So there's a spot towards the end of this match that I have to talk about because I thought it was tremendous, where Adam Cole is put across the table. Aleister Black gets up on the ring railing like he's going to do, you know, some sort of elbow drop or something like that. So he jumps up, gets some air, puts his knee up to his chest like he's going to do the Eddie Guerrero frog splash. And then he lands the double foot stomp, and they both go crashing through the table. I'd never seen that spot before. And that was also a holy shit number. Gunny started barking. It was great. So then we go. So let me just give a quick thumbs up to that match. Then we're going to go to the main event, which was Johnny Gargano versus Andrade Cien Almas. I had never seen either one of these two guys before. So I don't know them, as someone I know used to say, I don't know them from a house cat, you know? So I'm watching these two guys. I see the entrances and, you know, I'm going in completely blind, but I got to say, I love the entrances, you know, by the heel and his valet. Let me get the name right. Zelina Vega. Never seen her before. She was really good at ringside. I really liked her a lot. Johnny Gargano comes out. Barry, do you know what's the deal with the emoticon or the emoticon that he has on his vest and all the signs holding up? Because like I'm completely ignorant of this. Do you know what the story is with that?
I have any idea. No,
okay.
No.
Everyone's holding up the.
I don't know.
Holding up the signs with the emoticon. So excuse me, folks. I'm out of the loop on that. So the match starts. Barry, I'm going to throw it over to you. Tell us what you thought, and then I'll give my thoughts on this match.
So we're talking about the Gargano Cien Andrade Almas. Okay, so yeah, it was that good of a match, and it was. So I watched the match, and I had been down in the basement where I have the big screen TV, and I always try to make a point to watch the NXT takeovers, which is essentially it's their 2-hour pay per view, even though it's not really a pay per view any longer. So I think I guess I've seen every one. I don't think I've missed one, and every one is good. Some are great. Some are better than others. But at the end of the day, you walk away and you say, all right, let's see the big pay-per-view, the WWE pay-per-view top that the next day, and it never happens. So as I was watching this match, and I got to admit, the entire card was great. As I'm watching this match, and I'm about midway, 60% through, my son looks over to me and he goes, you know, Dad, this is maybe like one of the best matches I may have ever seen. And I'm like, yeah, you know, you're 100% right. And Gargano is a guy that what I've seen of Gargano, and I'm not, you know, again, it's probably limited what I see with either the WWE or NXT. But he's a guy I didn't know a whole lot about. I used to watch his tag team with Tommaso Ciampa, which was, you know, do-it-yourself, DIY, which was absolutely, they were just fantastic. They split up, obviously. But Gargano on his own, I didn't really know that much about. And as I'm watching this match, and I'd seen him on NXT, I realized that there's the great possibility that we are seeing the next big superstar in the making right here. And I know that we talked about this offline. It was me, you, and the great Brian Last, we discussed this, but there's a great parallel of Johnny Gargano and Daniel Bryan. You've got two guys who have this type of charisma where they can connect with the audience. They're both undersized, and they both are incredible in the ring. And I think, you know, I've said this before, that I believe Daniel Bryan would have been this generation's Hulk Hogan, Stone Cold Steve Austin, The Rock. Had he not been injured, he was on track to be the big superstar in this country. I think Gargano is, there's a great possibility he is the guy that's going to, he's going to be the next one like that. So this match was unbelievable. That being said, I never saw Andrade ever have a match like this. I'd seen him in Mexico as La Sombra, if I'm correct, but I had never seen him on NXT ever have a match at this kind of level. I always thought he was good, but I didn't think he was next level great. When this match was over, I thought he was that. I thought he was, you know, he's that fucking good. So this match blew me away. Zelina Vega. Now there's another one. Zelina Vega was in TNA for years as Rosita. And, you know, she's very tiny. I don't think she's even 5 foot or maybe just 5 foot. She's currently engaged to, Austin Aries. And she's a very, very good wrestler, just very, very small. But boy, has she found her calling as the valet or manager outside the ring. She like leads this team. She's absolutely incredible. So I thought this match was great. I certainly am going on forever about it. And when I read that Meltzer, and again, you know, whether you take stock in what he says or you don't, and there's obviously resentment, which I don't understand since the guy's been watching wrestling for close to 50 years, he gave it 5 stars. It's that good of a match. It deserves the 5 stars. So I was blown away when I saw it.
Yeah, I got to be honest with you. Like I said, I started watching this match and I basically was sitting there thinking, okay, prove it to me. Show me what all this hype is about. And I started watching it and they're like the 15 minute mark. They're already starting the 2 counts. And, you know, I'm sitting there going, wow. And then at the very beginning of the match, they were doing some chain wrestling that I haven't seen in years. And I'm going, wow, this is pretty good shit, man. This is really impressive. And they took it up. And what I like is they took it and built up all that until where you got to the peak, you know. There's an old line that someone once told me that Bill Dundee said to him about high spots. He said the high spot should be the high spot of the match. And that's where the term comes from. And they took this and they it was like building a house, and they started on the base level. They took it to the first floor and the second floor, and wow, color me impressed. I'm telling you, folks, I just became an NXT fan, and I don't know if the rest of the stuff on NXT is as good as this match was. But the bar has now been set for you in NXT, and holy crap, it was impressive. And you are absolutely right. I have to tell you something. I'm going to give a real big compliment here to the Zelina Vega girl that you were just discussing. As I sat and watched her, I was trying to figure out, okay, what's the comparison to this girl? And I'm going to compare her to somebody. And I want you people to understand, this is a really, really high praise for me. She reminded me of Sensational Sherry at ringside. The way that she was working the referee, she ends up doing the spot where she gives the flying head scissors to Gargano, who then is thrown into the ring post, which I thought was a tremendous spot. And then even the stuff, and I'm usually not a fan of the catfight stuff, but where Gargano's wife comes in out of the crowd and begins brawling with her and takes her to the back was tremendous. And the way it popped the crowd, it should have. It was really good stuff. So, yeah, this is a match that I'm going to tell all you people. This is something you almost never hear from me. This is a WWE match that deserves for you to go out of your way to see, because Meltzer was right. This is a five-star match. And, you know, how many two counts were there in this match? Good Lord, there must have been 20. And, I mean, two counts where you go, oh, this is it. No, you know, it's – and I talked about how I love Vince McMahon would go, you know, one, two, new champion, no. And I was convinced watching this match because I did not know what the result of the match was. I was like, oh, yeah, they're putting Gargano over totally in this match. And, you know, I love being surprised. I was surprised with this match. It was good. So, you know, I started thinking, Barry. So, yeah, both those matches, folks, the Suzuki Tanahashi, Gargano versus Andrade, Cien Almas. Go out of your way to watch those matches. So Barry, got me thinking, going to poke the bear a little bit here. Barry, you and I have been watching wrestling for way longer than both of us want to admit. We're getting up there, my friend. So
we are.
Barry, U.S. starting first, and then we'll go international. You recently came back from Mexico, so you've had a chance to see a little Lucha Libre down there. Expanding your horizons, we're proud of you here at Breaking Kayfabe. Give me your top five all-time favorite wrestlers in the U.S. And then we'll go international.
Well, so you're going to make this easy for me, huh?
All right, so I offered to give you this earlier, and you said, no, throw it at me just on the show so I can think spontaneously.
Yeah, you did. Boy, did I fuck that up. I wish I had a little time to think. So Billy Robinson is number one, will be my all-time favorite wrestler. Billy Robinson, Jack Briscoe. This is really, really tough for me. Terry Funk. It's such a huge list. I don't want to leave anybody out.
One more.
King Curtis.
Okay, so that's five. Now give me your top.
Well, it's only four.
We're not going back to that, are we?
Right. I think we're going back to that. And then my fifth. Oh, in the U.S., Harley Race. But you know what? This can change at any time. But sure, that's where I'm going to go.
Okay, so now give me your top five international wrestlers.
Since international?
You can include, I know, Jumbo Tsuruta. I was going to say.
I'm so fucking predictable. Yeah, Jumbo Tsuruta is going to be right there. Jumbo Tsuruta. This is even tougher in some ways because now I'm bouncing back and forth between Mexico and Japan. Toshiaki Kawada, Hurricane Ramirez. Oh, man. I don't know. I'm going to have to think of the other two. I'm only drawing a blank because I'm trying to narrow. Whenever we do this, it's like when we do any of our lists, we start out with 50 and we whittle it down. And in my head, I'm going, okay, so yeah, I'm going to start to whittle this down a little bit. I'll say Negro Casas because what he did in Mexico at one point was absolutely just incredible. And number five for me, this is a tough one. Number five, Tenryu. All right, fine, Tenryu.
Okay, I'm gonna go my U.S. wrestlers. My number one is Bobby Shane. Bobby Shane is the guy that got me interested in being a pro wrestling fan. Number two, Jack Briscoe. Number three, Ted DiBiase. Number four, the man I call BW, Barry Windham. And number five, I'm going to say Bobby Eaton.
Great choice.
International, I'm going to go, my number one would be Chigusa. Number two, I'll say Ricky Choshu. Three, I will say Dynamite Kid. Four, I will say, let me see here. Sayama. And great. Number five, the woman I had my big chance with, Bull Nakano. So that was those. That's my five. So. And a big chance blew that, you know. I'm going to speak to my wife, by the way. Barry and I were talking earlier about possibly making a trip over to Japan for one of the either the Wrestle Kingdom cards or something like that. And if I go over to Japan, folks, I'm going to tell you something. Before I leave, my wife's giving me a hall pass. Because, by God, if I run into Bull Nakano, I'm going to bring that ship home. That's all I got to say, Barry.
She is incredibly beautiful.
Oh, my
beautiful.
God. She's still friggin' gorgeous.
It's like nuts. It's nuts how beautiful she is. And I guess I realized in a sense, but I fucked up my list. I had Billy Robinson in America, even though he's international, but again, I only saw him here, so I had, you know, but yeah, I don't know.
I'm actually enough of a fan of Bull Nakano that I am on her Instagram page and she's posting pictures and I'm sitting there going, holy crap, how is this woman still this good looking? So yeah, it's pretty crazy. So before we go into our special look at Quentin Tarantino, Barry, I know that you recently have come back from Mexico. You had a chance to check out a little CMLL at Arena Mexico. Why don't you tell the folks how amazing that experience was?
It really was, too. So Mexico, to me, I love Mexico. It's just such a fantastic country. I had never been to Mexico City before, and it kind of struck me like, okay, you know, I've been to the coast. I spent a lot of time on the beaches. I've been to Tijuana, and that, I don't know if I could ever tell you what happened in Tijuana, but I can tell you what happened in Mexico City.
Did the Tijuana story involve a donkey in a bar?
It does not. So there was no donkey show. Yeah, and I think that's urban legend right there. Having been to Tijuana, I'm just not sure that really does occur. And if anybody doesn't know what we're talking about,
let's not talk about it because right now my sister is going to have to tell my father what this story's about. Go ahead.
I apologize for that. That's crazy. So anyway, I got to spend a few days in Mexico City, and I got to tell you, I absolutely love Mexico City. In talking with Jeff and the great Brian Last earlier, if I was 20 years younger, if I still remembered, I can speak some Spanish, I'm un poquito, but if I was fluent and I had a job, I would probably move to Mexico City. And you know, Mexico City is gigantic. I know that there are parts that are very dangerous. I've read all the warnings. I hear all the horror stories about the kidnappings and beheadings. On that note, Mexico City is so huge that I could have walked 10 miles in either direction of my hotel, which I did, and we were completely safe. And it's just a beautiful city. It's cleaner than New York. There's nobody peeing on the streets. Nobody's shitting on the streets. I didn't see any drug vials or hypodermic needles. The people are super friendly. Everyone says hello to you. They say hello to each other. But I checked in the hotel Tuesday night, and I inquired about Lucha Libre, and the young lady who was checking me in, her eyes lit up. She perked up, and she goes, Lucha Libre is in 1 hour. And I was like, well, how far is Arena Mexico? She goes, it's about 10 minutes away. That was it. I dropped my bags off. I got a cab driver, and I went to Arena Mexico. And being able to go to Arena Mexico, you know, the difference between wrestling in the U.S. and wrestling in, say, places like Mexico and Japan is really the cultural aspect of it. And, you know, I'm not going to say the card that I saw in ring was the best wrestling I've ever seen, because it clearly was not. However, the cultural aspect of the fact that, you know, Mexico is so revered, it's such an important part of the history and the culture of Mexico, it's treated with this ultimate respect. And I was able, you know, my cab driver got me in, he negotiated a ticket for me, I sat fourth row for $17, and to my left I had this young couple from Portland that come once a week. They come down from Portland, they'll drive down and spend the weekend, and they always come to wrestling. And to my right I had four girls and a guy who came over from Australia. And we sat there, and I was by myself, we sat there, we drank beer, and we just had the best fucking time. And the building it's an historical building. It's, you know, I'm going to assume it's 100 years old, if not close to it. And there are these gigantic murals that run from one side of the building to the other on the inside. And they're probably, I'll say they're 10 feet in width. I don't know how long it goes for. I'm going to guess it goes for, you know, a block at least. The most beautiful murals. And I posted some on my own personal Facebook page. But it was such an experience. And everybody there, you know, this is what the cool thing was. Everybody there is there to have fun. There was no negativity. There was no fans trying to get themselves over. No booing, unless they're booing a heel. Everybody is there to enjoy what they're doing, and everybody enjoyed it. Everybody pops for everything. I can't rate that experience really high enough that, you know, immediately on the plane ride home in the middle of the night last night, I'm going, all right, so I'm looking at this block of dates. Maybe I can get to Mexico here and get here. So, you know, Mexico is fairly inexpensive. The most expensive thing is going to be the flight. And I really want to get back sooner than later. Great food, great people. The music, the street musicians were fantastic. I went to an art gallery opening. You know, here was the funny thing. I'm strolling through a park and all of a sudden I see a building and there's a group of people and live music and I can tell it's an art gallery opening and I zip up a little bit and I walk in like I pretend I know what I'm doing and nobody says a word to me and I stayed and I enjoyed this art gallery opening. So that was pretty cool. But the main event that I saw that night was it was Mystico, Atlantis, and Volador Jr. versus Mephisto, Luciferno, and Mephisto, and it was awesome. You know, it's the wrestling is what the wrestling is. You know, Mystico is he's the guy. I think he's now called Caristico, if I'm correct. And this heel team of Mephisto, Efisto, and Luciferno, these guys are great. The best match on the card, and you know, with my lucha, I watch occasionally. I don't watch. There was a period where I used to watch nonstop, day and night. But there was a match between Cuatero and Angel de Oro. And this match, this guy Cuatero is this great heel that jumped Angel, Angel de Oro, before the match, and they beat the crap. It was real stiff for Lucha Libre. They were beating the crap out of each other, and they're going to have a mask versus mask match coming up in the near future. And this was kind of the setup for it. But just great. The food is great. You know, I was telling you about these grilled octopus tacos, which you referenced at the beginning of our show, and just, you know, wow. And I love Ozzy, but man, these tacos, if you've ever had grilled octopus, oh my God, were these tacos just fantastic. So I can't say enough about Mexico City. If you've never been, or you've been jaded, or your opinion has been clouded by the media in some form, yes, there are really dangerous areas, and there are shanty towns. But again, this is a city that is probably 80 miles long. It is gigantic. So there are good neighborhoods, bad neighborhoods. At the end of the day, I love this city.
So, sounds like a travelogue podcast is in the future for our own Barry Rose. You're leaving me, Rose. I know you are. So, what we're going to do now is we are going to take a look. We're not going to do our traditional top five where Barry and I each pick a top five from a particular type of movie, genre, or director. We're going to do a little discussion of Quentin Tarantino. Quentin Tarantino has been in the news a little bit with a little allegation thrown out there by Uma Thurman. Quentin Tarantino also got caught up in that whole Harvey Weinstein mess, as I believe the majority of his films, if not all of them, were all done under the auspices of Harvey Weinstein and Miramax Films. So, Barry, why don't you start us off? I know you are a huge, dare I say, mark for Quentin Tarantino and his film work. Tell us what you think is the best Quentin Tarantino film of all time, and then I'm going to offer some opinions.
Absolutely, too. So, let me quantify this before I say anything. So, this week was a little odd, and normally you and I are throwing out all types of facts and things, and you're still pretty good. This week I'm just kind of winging it, having been in Mexico for literally almost the last week. But I will tell you, I pulled up on the plane ride home, I was like, Quentin Tarantino's best films. And I was able to pull up three different lists, and all three of these lists are completely different, with the exception of the first movie, which they all agreed. But like Jackie Brown, one's got it, Jackie Brown at number 8, because Tarantino essentially has made 9 films. And they all, you know, one has got Jackie Brown at 8, the other one's got Jackie Brown at 2. One has got Inglourious Basterds at like 7, the other one's got it at 3. So there's like this disparity, and it's just an opinion, obviously, like everything else. However, the common denominator is number one, which is my number one, which is Pulp Fiction. It is, and I get so excited when I say it, I start to stutter. It is such a movie that you could see it the first time or you could see it the 10th time, and it's a roller coaster. And his movie direction, and Tarantino, you and I were also talking, he's got to be my favorite director of all time. You know, John Carpenter has done 4 or 5 films I like. Scorsese, my God, Scorsese's done. I don't think I've ever disliked a Scorsese movie, but I could see a Tarantino movie, and I really look forward to seeing it because his movies are so impactful. They're a little over the top, or they're a lot over the top. They're gratuitous and violence and sex and dialogue. At the same time, I connect with it. And my number one is Pulp, and it's you know, I was telling you the story last week or the week before, and I should also say, you and I have held off in having any sort of Tarantino discussion. Both of us have wanted to put Tarantino films like in the movie fights, you know, where Beatrice was fighting Gogo. We both were like, that's got to be on there. And we decided to hold off so we could have a Tarantino discussion because that fight is amazing. But Pulp Fiction, when I first saw Pulp Fiction, I saw it on my birthday. It was my 31st birthday. And I went to the movie theater that night with a young lady, and we had a few cocktails, so I had a slight buzz going. And I remember watching the movie, and I remember the scene where they are putting the needle into the heart to revive Uma Thurman. And there's like this countdown, and it's the direction. And I remember as I'm watching, I look at my hand, and my knuckles are white because I'm clenching the seat so hard. And that to me says something. That's like, wow, this movie's having like an impact on you. So I walked out of the theater that night, and that would have been October 1994. And I walked out of the theater and I said, that may have just been the greatest movie I have ever seen. And I know that I'm positive. I will tell you, this is the greatest match and this is the greatest food. I'm extremely positive like that. But at the same time, I watched this movie about a year ago with my son, and my son was 15 years old, and he's like, can I watch it? And I sat there, and this was probably the 15th, 20th time I've watched this movie. This is a great fucking movie, Pulp Fiction. It really is.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things about this movie that's so great is I really love the way that he sucks you in by almost presenting the end of the movie at the very beginning of the movie. And the one, you know, here again, one of the things that you and I, when we've discussed different Tarantino films, when we brought up Reservoir Dogs a few episodes ago, the dialogue in this movie is so just the subtle nuances, the seemingly inane conversation, Samuel L. Jackson's conversation about wanting to walk the earth like Kane from the TV show Kung Fu. It's just like so epic. This movie also grabbed the ghost of John Travolta and pulled him back into being a major, major player in film. And John Travolta in this film as, you know, Vincent Vega was just amazing. The change in hairdo, there's a great scene in the movie where they're going to see Ving Rhames. Help me out. What was his character's name again?
Marcellus Wallace.
That's it, Marcellus Wallace. They're going to see Marcellus Wallace. And Bruce Willis is standing at the bar just having something to drink, and he walks up and Travolta walks up to him and he says, can I help you, friend? And he goes, I ain't your friend, Palooka. it's just like so funny. And it's a great, so many things are happening in this movie that you have to keep track. You know, the scene with Harvey Keitel where he's the fixer, and you know, and one of the things that Tarantino does that's so amazing, I was watching a Tarantino film last night, and I'll discuss that, is he reaches back to the past. Think about Kill Bill, how he, you know, revived the careers, if only for a moment in time, of David Carradine. You know, Michael Parks from the old TV show Then Came Bronson has been a staple of Tarantino films. You know, and it's one of the things he does that I love is how he manages to find these niche roles. You know, Pam Grier had been probably largely forgotten about as the queen of blaxploitation movies in the 70s. She comes back as the lead in Jackie Brown. Help me out. I completely threw a blank on that.
Jackie Brown.
Jackie Brown. Okay, I'm sorry. And she was incredible in that. And Robert Forster, who no one had heard of in 10 years, plays the lead aside, and he was great in that. And I love that Tarantino is able to bring that out of these actors that we haven't heard of or haven't seen in so long. And this is, to me, this is obviously, and this is high praise because there's other Tarantino movies that I really love too, but this is the penultimate of Tarantino's career was Pulp Fiction.
That's a great word too, penultimate. And I think that's the first time we've ever used that. So
breaking ground here on Breaking Kayfabe.
We are highbrow, if nothing else, to use the word penultimate.
Exactly. So, you got to love that.
I don't know if Jim Cornette's using this word. I don't know that.
Probably not. So, but I will say, I referenced the fact that I had a chance to watch a Tarantino movie last night, and it was actually quite amusing in retrospect. Tarantino is of course, most well-known as a director, but he's also done some other work, and I'm going to discuss one of his other movies that he did not direct. It was where he was a writer in it, but in this particular movie I'm going to reference, he was actually one of the co-stars of the movie, and that's the movie From Dusk Till Dawn. This is a Robert Rodriguez film, and Tarantino plays one of the lead heels. It's about two brothers who have one brother has escaped from jail with the help of his other brother, and they are making a run for Mexico. There we go. Speaking about Mexico again, Barry. And they get over the border with the help of an innocent family, and they go to a place called the Titty Twister. And boy, are they in for a big surprise. And what's great about From Dusk Till Dawn is George Clooney, who plays Tarantino's brother, because they look exactly alike, let's be honest. They play these really menacing heels, and there's a situation that happens in the movie where Clooney basically turns babyface towards the end. But I'm sitting there watching the movie with my wife, and my wife is, let's be honest, not a Tarantino fan. And she's watching the movie, and she's kind of like, "What are you watching?" And she's sort of, you know, doing the, reading a book or playing on her phone or something, not really, you know, one eye on the television. And so the moment that she has asked me this question is literally 30 seconds before the big reveal at the end of the movie about what's really going on at this bar. And I looked at her and started laughing. I said, "Get ready, because this movie's about to take a 180-degree turn that no one sees coming. And it's going to become a complete, it's not a bank robber film anymore or a cops and robbers films. This is about to become a horror film." And she sat there, and all of a sudden, when the turn happened, she was actually like, the eyes kind of got wide, and she's like, "What the hell is happening here?" That is a crazy good film that he didn't direct. Robert Rodriguez was fantastic. And let's be honest, the thing that everyone remembers from Till Dusk Till Dawn, Barry, what's the one scene that every guy remembers from that movie?
I think we should say even every girl remembers that scene. Yes. Because I remember when my wife and that's, again, I'm dating myself, but when this movie came out in 1996, I believe it was, 96 or 97, my wife and I were actually dating at the time, and we were in the theater, and she was completely digging it. And it's the scene where Selma Hayek comes out and she dances. It is arguably one of the great scenes in any movie at any point. It certainly is where everything changes in the movie. You know, it takes a completely different turn. But, I mean, what guy, what heterosexual male didn't sit there, watch Salma Hayek, and think, "My God, would I love to get an hour with Salma Hayek?" Absolutely.
Her character's name was Satanico Pandemonium. And the introduction that she gets from Danny Trejo, who plays the bartender in the Titty Twister, is absolutely amazing. He gives one of the great promos introducing Selma Hayek. So here's a little bit of trivia on this. Selma Hayek apparently had a real fear of snakes and didn't want to do the scene. So director Robert Rodriguez told her, "Well, okay, fine, but if you don't want to do the scene, I'm not going to have you in the movie, because Madonna called me, and Madonna is willing to do the scene and wants the part." And that's why Selma Hayek did the scene that everyone remembers, and it's absolutely amazing. And yeah, just a fun, stupid, this really could be a, you know, like a stupid movie, because this isn't highbrow art here. This is just dumb,
but it's fun.
It's great. Yeah. And great cast, Harvey Keitel, Juliette Lewis, Cheech Marin, who plays three different roles, and every one of them is great. Danny Trejo, Selma Hayek. Good fun stuff. So, Barry, why don't you tell us your thoughts on one of his other films?
Yeah, absolutely, too. And I got to say, From Dusk Till Dawn is such a great movie. And again, another movie that I sat down and I watched with my son about a year ago, and he said exactly the same thing that you and Kim just referenced with that, was that, you know, my son said, that's like the biggest turn ever in a movie. It went from, like, this crime movie all of a sudden to this vampire movie. I know, wasn't it awesome? You know, so, yeah, it's just, I can't say enough about that movie. It's highly underrated. People who have seen it do tend to love it. If anybody that is listening to us, and we certainly have a pretty loyal group, if you've never seen this movie, you got to go see this movie, and you got to let us know your thoughts on the Salma Hayek scene, because it really is at a next level. He did so many great movies, and again, we're kind of flowing with it this week. We don't really have a set format. Jackie Brown was great, and you touched on the reason why Jackie Brown was great. First off, the story is kind of cool. It has a great cast. You know, you've got these people that Quentin Tarantino, the beauty of all of his films is he takes actors that you may not have seen for 20 or 30 years, people that might have been somebody that he admires from the 70s, which is really the bulk of what, you know, of what his film work, what he really seems to admire. But at the same time, he'll take all these other actors, and, you know, this one has got Samuel L. Jackson, which has been in several of his movies. Chris Tucker just plays this great character that is only around for the first few minutes of the film. Robert De Niro's in Jackie Brown, and Bridget Fonda, who, my God, and I don't know if Bridget Fonda even made a movie after this ever again. She married Danny Elfman from Oingo Boingo and then had kids, and I think she's a stay-at-home mom. But Bridget Fonda in this movie is the finest she has ever looked by far. And she's a beautiful woman, but I saw her in this movie and I was like, oh my God, Bridget Fonda. But it's a great story. You know, Tarantino is such a great storyteller. He's so unique with the stuff that he can do. And I absolutely loved it. And Jackie Brown was really funny because when I saw it, I walked out of the theater and I was like, you know, I don't know if I like this one as much as his other movies. And it took two or three, it's a little more subtle. You know, where Pulp Fiction hits you right over the head, Reservoir Dogs hits you right over the head, Kill Bill, which came out a few years later, obviously, you know, clubbed you over the head. Jackie Brown is subtle. But again, Tarantino, and you said this about 20 minutes ago, and good thing that I made a note because I would never remember this, Tarantino's strength is his dialogue. And it's the dialogue between characters. And this is going to segue into the dialogue of Kill Bill Volume 2. There's a scene there between Beatrice, played by Uma Thurman, and the David Carradine, who's Bill, and they talk about Superman. And it goes on for 4 or 5 minutes. And it's this, you know, I sit there and I wonder and I say, how the fuck can somebody write dialogue like this? And this is not dialogue. This is not back and forth, you know, two-line dialogue. This is full-out paragraphs that goes on for 4 minutes. And it's about Superman, and he breaks down superhero characters and why Superman is the best. And I remember seeing it, walked out, and I said, this is it. This is why this guy is a fucking genius. This is the reason right here why he's a genius. And he is. He's absolutely a filmmaking genius. The criticisms of Tarantino, which I fully get, gratuitous violence, gratuitous language. There's a lot of racial shit in his movies. Some of the sex is, dare I say, deviant. You know, bring out the gimp and shit like that. But at the same time, it's groundbreaking. He's doing stuff that's never been done on a big stage, a level that I don't think any other movie director really had ever done. And his style of filmmaking, which you also referenced, is that he does this kind of lateral filmmaking where the story is everywhere. You know, he'll tell you the end of the story first and then explain it throughout the movie and everything intercuts, and that is his style of filmmaking. And other directors have done that, but I don't think anybody's ever done it to the degree that Tarantino has. So I'm a huge fan. Jackie Brown, I absolutely love. There's not a film that I don't like. If I was going to say my least favorite Tarantino movie, and I should also say is that if you're on the Breaking Kayfabe with Badger and Barry Facebook group page, we'd like to see your list of number 1 through 9 of your films. Jeff and I will both be putting up our lists of movies 1 through 9. But for me, number 9 is probably Inglourious Basterds. And it's still a great movie. You know, if it wasn't, you know, if it wasn't a Tarantino film, or, you know, if I wasn't comparing 1 through 9, I would say that's a great fucking movie. But as movies go, it's a little less for me than the other movies. The saving grace, what I think the highlight and the home run of that movie, is Christoph Waltz. And it's really the movie that kind of introduced him to the U.S. He's made several movies since. He was also in The Hateful Eight, which was the last Tarantino film, which we can also talk about. But he is a major league star. And it was the kind of thing that when you see this movie, and I had no idea, I was like, wow, this guy just stole the fucking movie. Like, this guy was that good. He really stole the movie. And he was playing this evil Nazi. But, you know, dare I say, there was something likable at times about him. So just great. You know, I think my 1, 2, and 3, boy, is this hard, because this can change like every other day. Number 1 is going to be Pulp. Number 2 is Kill Bill Volume 1. Number 3 is Reservoir Dogs. And number 4 is Kill Bill Volume 2. That can change. How about you? I know what your number 1 is, but what's your number 2 or 3?
Yeah, I'm probably going to go number 1, Pulp Fiction, number 2, Kill Bill Volume 1, and I think my number 3 would be Kill Bill Volume 2. That, you know, that to me is boy, I recently saw that they've apparently put together some sort of, much like they did with The Godfather, where they did it and combined the two films, and it's over 4 hours. But that's a way to see that movie. You know, the way that you see The Godfather in that, you know, 1 and 2 as the timeline, you know, where they start the movie, the Godfather saga, as they call it, with the De Niro character, and evolve it into the Brando character. And Hill and Kill Bill, they don't do it sequentially like that, but they combine the whole movie, so you're able to see the entire, you know, storyline all in a four hour sort of version. And I haven't done that, but I'd really like it, because I really, really enjoyed both versions of that movie. So and I think the point you made about Inglourious Basterds is true. That's probably one of my lesser enjoyed Tarantino films. And, you know, you said it absolutely right. You say that Inglourious Basterds is my least favorite Tarantino film. That means it's like a B+. You know, we're not talking about a movie that's a crap fest that no one should watch. It's still a really great movie. One of the things I was thinking about as you were talking about Jackie Brown, you know, you have to remember Jackie Brown was his follow-up to Pulp Fiction, where he had become this huge, huge media celebrity and star. So now, and Pulp Fiction was up for Academy Awards. Everyone had rated it as just this genius filmmaking. So now he's got to follow up. And essentially what he did was he followed it up with Jackie Brown, which wasn't, as Barry said, that big splashy movie. This is a movie that did a slow burn and a slow buildup to the end and the go home. And it's every bit as enjoyable as Pulp Fiction, but it's a different story told a different way. And if you appreciate it in that context, you can see what a great film Jackie Brown is also. And, you know, just really good stuff. One of the films I wanted to talk about, Barry, that, again, is not a film that Tarantino directed, but it's a film that he wrote that I've seen recently that is also in the pantheon of Tarantino film work, is True Romance. And I love the description on IMDb. In Detroit, a lonely pop culture geek marries a call girl, steals cocaine from her pimp, and tries to sell it in Hollywood. Meanwhile, the owners of the cocaine, the mob, track them. That sounds like such a crazy film, but that's exactly what happens. And, you know, Christian Slater, I've always said, in retrospect, as you look at this film, he's essentially playing Tarantino, because Tarantino was a guy, when he began writing films, before he had his breakout with Reservoir Dogs, he was a guy that worked at a video store. And he was a complete movie nut, and he threw all that into the story that became Reservoir Dogs. And, you know, True Romance is just like this roller coaster, again, with a tremendous cast, Gary Oldman almost unrecognizable as the pimp, with the dreads and the gold teeth, Brad Pitt in one of his first roles as the stoner buddy who, like, basically sleeps on the couch. And of course, one of the scenes that everyone remembers is the famous scene with Christopher Walken and, help me out, Barry. Why am I drawing a blank? His father.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Jesus Christ.
Dennis Hopper. Thank you. Dennis Hopper.
Right. Right.
Where they basically face off, and Dennis Hopper knows he's getting ready to leave the facility, but he decides he's going to verbally throw down with Christopher Walken and talk to him about his Italian heritage. And it's one of the most awesome scenes ever in film history. And just a fantastic, You know, there again, we talk about Tarantino's use of dialogue, and you know, and the scene between Walken and Hopper is really one of the all-time best in film history. So I know you enjoyed True Romance also, Barry.
Yeah, and I should say, too, you left this out, which I cannot believe, but one of your favorite fight scenes.
Oh, yeah, honest, absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah, that's everybody's. I mean, holy shit.
Yeah, the fight scene between Patricia Arquette and James Gandolfini in a hotel room where parts of a toilet are used within the fight. And yeah, that's definitely one of film's all-time great fight scenes. Patricia Arquette is – she's kind of an unusual. She's one of those women that you don't think of her as being, you know, necessarily drop dead gorgeous or something like that. But she's got a real kind of quirky sex appeal at this point in her life. She's got something going on with them teeth. I don't know what's going on with that, but she's got a real quirky, and her character's name is Alabama, which is it's a great hooker name. She plays a hooker in the movie. Her name is Alabama. So
yeah, that fight scene too. If you remember the hotel room when it's all over, there's blood in like every inch. It's all over the walls and the ceiling, and Patricia Arquette. But there's somebody right there that, at the end of the day, what a great body of work. She's a great actress. Anything she does, she makes it watchable. And she's underrated. Nobody ever talks about, you know, I think she's actually won a couple of awards, strangely enough. But she's not one of these like A-list type of actresses, and she should be. You know, the teeth are a little off, but maybe that's part of her attraction. You know, she's not Hollywood perfect. You know, that she has summer teeth. Some are going this way and some are going that way.
I'll tell you real quick, and I'll let you continue. A film that she was in that I really liked was a film with where she was with Flirting with Disaster, where she was with Ben Stiller. But that's a great quirky movie, and she's hilarious in that movie. So anyway, I just wanted to say my piece about Patricia Arquette. Go ahead, finish what you were saying.
No, we can talk about her for hours. She was on, you know, she was on that show with Steve Buscemi. What was that called? The one where it was in Atlantic City. He played Lucky.
Oh God,
Jesus!
I know what you're talking about. Go ahead, I'll find it.
It was a great. You'll find it. But in any case, she played a character on there, and she's a woman now. She's probably 50 years old, so she's not a kid, and she's filled out, but she still has this. She has this older woman sexiness. She's not
Boardwalk Empire.
Boardwalk Empire. I was going to say Broadway something. Boardwalk Empire, and she's filled out. She's gained a little weight. She's a little more wrinkly. At the same time, I think it works with her. She's got this kind of mature woman appeal that I love her. I absolutely just love her. But so you talked about Tarantino with working at the video store, and you're 100% right. So Tarantino was working at this real famous video store in California, and it was called Video Archives, and it was kind of the place that, you know, this guy Roger Avery worked there, and Daniel Cinder worked there, and these were people that were that also have careers in films, and everybody would go there, and primarily because Tarantino's got like 160 IQ. He's a certified genius, and he would have this knowledge of film from all over the world, whether it was Japan or China. He loves kung fu movies, obviously, and people would go there just to be able to talk with him and to be able to learn about film. And he actually wrote the screenplays for True Romance, Natural Born Killers, and Reservoir Dogs while he was working at Video Archives. When the store closed up, which I'm going to say is probably late 90s, he actually bought their inventory of 8,000 titles, just to give you an idea, which he currently owns. His first job, and it's funny because I've done research on Tarantino, just because he's such a unique, he's out there. I mean, he's definitely way out there. His first job, so in Los Angeles, in New York used to have this too, but Los Angeles used to have these X-rated newspapers. Actually, New York did too, with Screw Magazine. And you would put $2 in quarters, and you'd be able to get a copy from like a newspaper stand. You'd have the machines. And his first job, he would actually go and collect the quarters from these. His second job was he was actually an usher at the Pussycat Theater, which is a porn theater somewhere in the Valley or in Torrance, California. So, you know, here's a guy that just he likes – obviously likes the seediness a little bit, which is obviously you know, started at a young age based off of his employment history, but at the same time, you can look at his movies. And Natural Born Killers is another one that we didn't even bring up that he wrote the screenplay for, and I mean, that is a really good, and Brad Pitt also in that movie, that's a really, really good movie, I think. And Juliette Lewis, who I love as well.
I'll tell you who, to me, stole that movie, and it's a guy that we discussed on episode one of Breaking Kayfabe. And that's Rodney Dangerfield, who plays a complete heel in that movie, but he was awesome in that movie.
And who is the mom? Rosanna Barr.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, and also the very scuzzy Tom Sizemore, extremely scuzzy Tom Sizemore, in my opinion, kind of also stole that film when he's telling the story of what happened to his mother. Do you remember that?
No, I haven't seen that film in, God, 15 or 20 years, but go ahead.
This is the kind of shit where we're just, you and I are just riffing at this point. We're not, but he tells this story of, cause he plays this slightly psychotic cop that's trying to catch Mickey and Mallory. And, he tells the story how his mother was killed by the sniper, from the bell tower in Texas. And he's, you know, Tom Sizemore, if you've ever Googled him or heard any of these stories, you know, holy shit, this guy is, you know, you name it, he's done it. And it's all illegal and immoral. It's horrific. He's a horrible, horrible human being. That said, he can command a presence when he's on screen, and he definitely does. Rodney Dangerfield was great. That might have been one of Rodney's last roles, right?
I believe so, yeah. And he I think he spends most of the movie in his underwear.
Oh, remember how creepy that was?
Yeah, he was very stalkery to his daughter in that, and it was not a. Yeah. That's probably not one you want to watch with Zach just yet. I got to be honest.
No, I'll wait a little bit. And Woody Harrelson was great. It's just such a good movie. I actually said Brad Pitt, and I meant to say Woody Harrelson. But yeah, just tremendous. Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2. So we touched on it briefly. Wow. And I don't know which kill was my favorite. The one with Gogo, I guess, has to be my favorite. And is that even a kill? There's 100 people that are killed in that movie. And that's a definite takeoff of a lot of the kung fu chop suey movies that Tarantino just absolutely loves. He loves that genre of film. But that scene, especially at the very end, where there are bodies and body parts and pools of blood, there are 100 bodies that are there. If I'm worth 88 bodies, right, that are there, literally, they're just everywhere. That is such a dramatic scene. And I remember, again, I saw this movie with my wife when it first came out, and I remember I walked out and, you know, it just unbelievable. It's such an impact that Tarantino's films have made on me. So, yeah, I'm really glad that we got the opportunity to talk about them today.
Yeah, I love the scene in Kill Bill Volume 1, and I'm trying to scroll and find it here. I can't remember the actress's name, who plays the head of the Tokyo mob. Do you remember who that actress was?
It was Lisa Ling, yes.
Yes, and the scene at the table where she, dare I say, has to reprimand one of the members of the Tokyo mob not to bring up her family heritage. And the results of what happens after that is very twisted and hilarious, but very shocking. But it's great stuff. A couple things I wanted to bring up just to go back on. From Dusk Till Dawn, we talked about the great dialogue. Here's one to look for. The scene where they're hiding out in a Winnebago, and they're hiding in the Winnebago's bathroom with Juliette Lewis, Tarantino, and Clooney, and Clooney makes a reference. He says, you know, he goes, I want you to stay cool. And Tarantino then goes, what do you mean by that? You trying to say I'm not cool? Is that what you're saying? And the dialogue that goes back and forth between the, and it's obviously something that Tarantino wrote, because it's so, you know, just like, where did this come from? But the scene is so funny, and it's such an example of Tarantino's great writing abilities. I wanted to also discuss that one of the things that I really enjoyed about the Johnny Gargano, Andrade Cien Almas match, both guys, you know, I talk about how in the past, over the last 10 years or so, when you look at a professional wrestler, there's so much that you've come to expect. You've got a guy that's usually kind of, I won't say gassed up, but muscled up. there's always some sort of tattoo somewhere, the tribal tat on the arm or on the shoulders. It seems like it was just like a look. You know, we used to joke in the 80s that every wrestler you'd ever see outside the ring always had his jeans tucked into his boots and was wearing a fanny pack. That was like the wrestler look. Well, after, you know, a few years ago, the wrestler look was you were muscled up and you had innumerable tattoos. And one of the things I used to always say is, you know, part of wrestling that when I was first becoming a fan that was great was not everybody looked the same. You know, you had so many different guys with, you know, you had Dusty Rhodes, who looked like an overweight guy. And then you'd have, you know, a guy like Jack Briscoe, who looked like he was an athlete, but they both drew money, you know, looking two different ways. And I love the fact that both these guys in this NXT match, neither one of them had a single tattoo that I could see. And that was that's such a refreshing change for me to watch a match where you're not watching two guys that are completely tatted up. And neither one of them looked like they were, you know, going to be in the next Marvel superhero film. There were guys with good physiques, good wrestling physiques, but they weren't completely roided out and muscled up. They were two guys who were in shape who could go 30 minutes plus. And it's something that I really appreciated. So, that being said, we're going to wrap up now. But before we do, I believe my friend Mr. Barry Rose might have an announcement about June 2nd and what and who is coming to Lutz, Florida and the CWS Fan Fest. Barry, why don't you take it?
Jeff, is it Lutz or is it Lutz?
Well, we've done a deep dive on that, and my sister sent me a text that I forwarded to you, Barry, with a mea culpa.
Yeah, it is pronounced Lutz, and again, it's I've spent a lot of time in that area, so maybe I had the upper hand, and I knew what was going to be the end result. But at that point, I am happy to announce that your sister, Reen, will be at CWF Legends Fan Fest 3, June 2nd, taking place in Lutz, Florida. And joining her will not only be Bob Roop, Steve Kern, Buddy Colt, but our latest announcement, the former NWA World's Heavyweight Champion, who won the title February the 11th, 1969, in Tampa, Florida, coming home to Tampa, the place he won the title, Dory Funk Jr. will be joining us. So, Buddy Colt, Dory Funk Jr., Bob Roop, Steve Kern, your sister Reen, you better make your plans to be there now.
That's a pretty good get for you and David Penzer. I'll give you credit. So, yeah, Dory Funk Jr. Man. Wow, that is like wrestling history 101 right there. I mean, talk about a guy that's got some stories and some memories I'm sure he's got to sell. Just absolutely unbelievable. Great get for you and David. Way to go. And really looking forward to that. So, before we go, I just want to say and tell everyone, you know, we are part of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. I recently had a chance to listen to our good friend Scott Bowden's Kentucky Fried Wrestling podcast. So I flip on the podcast and I see that it almost runs 2 hours, and he's got Doug Gilbert on there. And I'm thinking to myself, 2 hours. Wow, this is going to be a long listen. And I got to tell you something. The show goes by like he's there for 20 to 30 minutes. Doug Gilbert has some tremendous, tremendous stories about his brother, Eddie, his father, Tommy wrestling Lou Thesz, Barry, and stories about that. He's got stories about his trips to Japan. This is an episode of Kentucky Fried Wrestling not to miss, folks. So Scott Bowden, thumbs up, job well done. So Barry, anything before we go?
No, man, I'm looking forward to next week. And like I say, we're going to be putting up on the Facebook group page. Jeff's be putting up his top 9 Quentin Tarantino in sequential order. I'll be putting up mine. We want to hear your thoughts on that as well.
Okay, folks, we sure appreciate you joining us here on Breaking Kayfabe with Barry or Bowdrin and Barry. I've already forgot the name. What the hell am I doing? Follow me on Twitter at #BowdrinJeff. Special thanks to Brian Last, the great Brian Last, and the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Breaking Kayfabe is, in fact, if you didn't know by now, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. So until next time, have a good one.